Is everybody in? Is everybody in? The show is about to begin.
This is Concerts That Made Us. I'm your host, Brian. And as always, rate and review us on iTunes and find us and follow us on social media. Now, this week, I'm joined by the brilliant Irish singer-songwriter, Colm Gavin. We're going to take a listen to one of Colm's songs before we get talking to him. So, without further ado, let's get on with the show.
Crooked alleys and hallways, always tomorrow feels like yesterday. The latest trick or runaway, it's all the same since baby went away. Lights are on, but the shutters down. Everyone's clown, a party piece, a hand-me-down. And all I hear is the bitter sound of an empty bed now that baby's not around. They ask me how I'm feeling, yeah, but it's too soon to know. It seems she's always dressed up and I got no place to go. I wanna call this quits and just admit what we both know, but she's all I've ever wanted and I love her so. One day I'll find the words I need to say. Each night I pray we'll meet again on some sunny day. For now it seems all I ever say is it ain't the same since baby went.
Hi, Colm. You're very welcome to Concerts That Made Us.
Thanks, dude. Pleasure to be here.
Oh, it's an honor to have you. So for any of the listeners that may not have heard of you, would you like to give them some background?
Sure. Well, my name's Colm Gavin. I'm finding this more and more difficult lately than ever to define what it is that I do. But I suppose I would be a singer-songwriter in the traditional sense of the term. So my heroes, I had very unconventional heroes as a teenager. I loved the music of Burt Bacharach, Irving Berlin, people who would be, I suppose, associated with the Great American Songbook, George and Ira Gershwin. And that became characteristic of my playing, or what you would call my sound, so to speak, during the time that I studied in the Clondalkin School of Music. And that was my formal training under the great Peter Stanton, who now unfortunately is no longer with us. But I am signed to Bio Records. That's the home of the First Lady of Celtic Music, Moya Brennan. Bio Records is like a family, you know, and from day one, they made me feel like, I won't say part of the furniture, but certainly an adopted strafe of some description, you know.
It's a very unusual musical influences to hear coming from someone so young. You know, you must hear that an awful lot. How were you exposed to the likes of those artists?
So I studied at a place called the Clondalkin School of Music, and my teacher, Peter Stanton, would have been, his musical lineage would have gone back to, he was in the Army No. 1 band in Cork, and he was in marching bands, and sort of, you think of music in terms of formation. That was his, so he would have played scores from, the HMS Pinafore or West Side Story, and his mental soundscape would have been shaped by the music of the 30s and the 40s. So swing and ragtime and sort of early big band jazz and stuff like that. And when you think about the melodic and harmonic sensibilities that comes with that kind of music, if you teach then as a music teacher, that I think that comes through you. And that's the way you mark the barometer on what you, I suppose, good taste and bad taste. And that just rubbed off on me from very early on, I guess.
Yeah. It's something I'd admire now. I'd kind of have an older taste in music myself, all the way back to the 50s, right up to modern day. But I always find myself going back to the 50s, 60s, 70s, and I just have it ingrained in me that no matter what comes out nowadays, you can't beat the classics. You know, that's where it started. That's the formation of music nowadays. You know, music would be so strange nowadays if there was no, you know, as you said, Burt Bacharach, no Elvis Presley, no Beatles. It'd be a very strange musical world. But what would you say was your first musical memory?
I get asked questions of a similar nature a lot, and I give a different answer every time. Every time I think about it, something else comes to mind. But, you know, I grew up in a very special place, in the sense that time had something to do with it, but also I had a lot of friends who were all around the same age at the same time, and the world was changing at the same rate for everybody. I mean, I remember the change over to the euro. I remember the currency change. I remember talk of the Celtic Tiger. And when your generation is almost like a prototype of something that's completely new, I think you're very aware of it, and I certainly was. And the role that music played for me was, anytime you're in the company of a large group of people, you have the opportunity to be somebody different. And the great performers who caught my attention were people like Jim Croce, Harry Chapin, Paul Simon, Randy Newman. And I grew up, my best friend Shane Mulligan, his grandfather Dermot Kenny, would have, you know, as kids when we were hanging around the house, I say kids, were probably 10, 11, 12. He would come home from work. He was a well-reputed hairdresser. And in the evenings, he'd come home, and he was very clued in with modern day music too. He'd come home with a new CD, and it could be Ray LaMontagne's first album. And he'd say, I heard a great review on the radio about this, so I just bought it. And he was cool in that sense with his musical taste. And they had a great sound system in their house. So he'd play Ray LaMontagne's new record, or he'd play something by the band, you know, it could be The Night They Drove Old Dixie Down or Bob Dylan's 30th anniversary concert, you know, that kind of stuff. Like, and I remember hearing what would be defined as unusual sounds as a young teen, and just really being captivated by it, and knowing that this wasn't this wasn't coming from the diaspora that my friends were. This wasn't the kind of music that they listened to, which the big song when I was about 12 was the Cha-Cha Slide. And you go to, I remember going to, or Fat Man Scoop. I remember going to like school birthday parties and everybody sort of nervously dancing on, you know, your friend Gavin's tiled floor, his mother's tiled floor, doing the Cha-Cha Slide. Because you just thought that's what you were supposed to be doing. So music, like it, there was a divergence at around the time I was about 12, because that's when I went to study music. So yeah, it was kind of a hodgepodge, you know?
Yeah, I get you. Did, personally for me, when I was 10, 11, I was a huge Elvis Presley fan. And I used to, this will give you an indication of how cool I was as a child. I used to think it was great to boast to my friends in school that I had every song Elvis Presley ever recorded in my collection. Now, that didn't make me very cool, but did you find that the artists that you liked, the older ones, the, you know, the bigger ones, the ones that weren't as popular with younger people, did you find it's kind of an uncool thing growing up?
I don't know whether it's having the benefit of hindsight or life perspective, but when you look back now, I think of it in today's terms. You don't encounter even people in their late teens who will come out and say that I love the music of Harry Chapin or of Joan Baez or big band music. Like what they think old music is like Oasis, do you know what I mean? And for me, it was like, hearing Champagne Supernova for the first time could have been 4 years ago, even if though it might have been when I was very, very young. But I think it's character developing. Like if you're, one of my biggest interests was Frank Zappa. I remember going on a family holiday to Florida and there was a huge sort of reduced sale bin in this. It wasn't the golden discs, but it was in a section of a Kmart. And there was like Hot Rats by Frank Zappa for $4, or Son of Mr. Green Jeans for, like, if you bought that and you bought Live at the Fillmore East, it was only $6. And I just thought, you're giving away this golden stuff that every kid who's going to school should be taught about this. Because for me, who has come along since the 1950s and 60s? And I would push into the 70s with the same degree of harmonic and melodic sensibility. So to me, this was my CDs were a treasure trove, and I had an old Discman that my mom had brought back from, my mom was a fashion buyer. She brought it back from Tokyo one time. And this was my little haven. You know what I mean? This was my little shrine of my myriad of CDs, like Bob Dylan, Frank Zappa. I had a neighbor who made me a CD of the Brodsky Quartet and the Best of Nina Simone. I just loved that. And it didn't, music wasn't something that I shared with people, because I knew the instantaneous response from a bunch of 14-year-olds when you say, have you ever heard My Baby Cares Just For Me by Nina Simone? Is what? So just didn't, you know, it was my own personal thing.
Yeah. You were obviously a lot wiser than I was to keep it to yourself.
Well, you can't help it. Like, I mean, if you find something that you think, if everyone knew about this, everybody would enjoy it as much as I do, then it's very hard to stay tight-lipped about it. You know?
Yeah, that's true. Before we get on to your gigs, the listeners were lucky enough to hear one of your songs there at the beginning. Would you like to tell them a bit about it?
So Since Baby Went Away is one of the tracks which is on my forthcoming EP, the 1992 tapes. And this ties in nicely with what we were talking about the music of the 50s, or specifically the music of people like Cole Porter, George and Ira Gershwin. And the biggest driving influence behind this was Randy Newman. And he has a songbook collection, which is just his song. It's him and the piano. Now, he's primarily a pianist, so the piano features a lot on his records. But he made this collection called Songbook, which is just some of his better known songs. And it's him and the piano. And I just thought, because his melodies and his harmonic strength sensibility is so strong, the songs carry over, even though it seems quite minimalist. And I wanted to take a collection of my own songs. And Since Baby Went Away is the only one that has featured on a previous record. It came out on my album, A Voice for the Urban Darlings. But the other four which hopefully you'll hear another one of them later in the show. They're totally, they've never been previously released. So it's a bit of an experiment to see how an EP of five songs, just piano and vocal will go over. But the response has been very positive so far. So,
well, good. It is a very good song. I've listened to it a couple of times now, and I really enjoyed it. I know listeners are going to really enjoy it too. But what's your process for songwriting? I've heard a couple of different takes from different artists I've interviewed. Now I'm intrigued to see what your version of songwriting is.
I always ascribe to the John Lennon approach of 99% of the job is just showing up at the desk. And what COVID or whole pandemic period has afforded us all is the ability or the time to reassess whatever our routine or our process is. And I would always say in interviews like this that, oh, I do my 3 hours a day and I show up and I edit for the first hour and then sort of process new ideas. But really, I would do that when I wasn't on the road, because if I was on the road for 2 weeks, no writing would get done. So having, I won't say the benefit of not having gigs, but just being forced into a situation where you couldn't tour, you couldn't perform, there were no gigs, and everything had just gone virtual, then all you've got is time in the day to spend. So that gave me a year to really assess my process, which has always kind of been the same. I just sit at the piano and make the coffee. And it'll start with, it's usually like with something like Since Baby Went Away, I remember listening to nothing but Ray Charles for about a month. And he has a record called Ray Charles Sings Country Hits. And when Ray Charles sings country, it sounds like the blues. Now that's for, you know, theoretical reasons, but it just, there was something about his voice and the ambience of the piano. I've always been drawn to piano driven records. I don't know why that is. And I liked the swingy, lilty thing of, and like a directionless major seven chord movement, you know, like it, I've rearranged it since, but on the new record, it begins sort of in C major and then I move it to G. Like you get the sense there's a strong F major seven in the beginning, which gives you the sense we're at the four of C, and then that moves eventually to G. But I just like that sort of ambiguity, you know, that imbalance and that kind of, that it to my thinking, that kind of adds to the sentiment of the lyric too, but that could be just me. So.
Yeah, that's an interesting one. Now I've the oddest one I've probably heard now, and I know there's a couple of famous singers as well that have used it in the past, is they'll pick a word out of the dictionary and try to make a song with it, or they'll say be reading a magazine, pick out five words and try to turn that into a song. I find that a very strange way to approach it, and like you're almost making it harder on yourself and less personal, maybe.
Yeah. You know? Well, it's funny that you should say about making it personal, because I tend to write from a character perspective more so than the typical narrative of from me to you, which is like 90% of what musical syntax is anyway. Like, for example, on this record, there's a song called Joanne, and it sounds like a very straightforward love song to a girl named Joanne, but it's not. I was asked to do a couple of songs for a musical by a friend of mine who's based with a theater company in Donegal. And the musical never got made, but I was left with this bunch of songs. And when you listen to the lyric of Joanne, if you take the music, if you're not thinking of it from a melodic perspective, it's just a conversation between two people. Well, it's a one-sided conversation. You know, as there's something you want to say, I'm sure you don't feel like talking this way. You can feel the uncertainty of the guy, you know? And so I think I know two Joannes. Do you know what I mean? But basically, to answer your question simply, is if I was to rely on being sad every time I wanted to write a sad song, my psychiatrist bills would be through the roof, you know? So,
yeah, I get
you. You know what I mean?
Yeah. We'll get on to your gigs now. I'm very excited to hear about these. The first gig you've ever played, what was it?
I mentioned earlier, I studied at the Clondalkin School of Music, and every year we used to have a summer recital, so to speak. So whatever pieces, we all did grade pieces through the Royal Victoria School of Music or College of Music in London. So you get, like, for very rudimentary players, you get a piece like Malaguena, which is like a faux Spanish piece. And that would, a lot of them were transcribed by people like Alan Grundy and Colin Tribe. And they were basically exam pieces, but we would arrange some of them for maybe a 4 or 5 piece band performance. And we used to do a lot of what we would have considered staples, like Georgia on My Mind, Willin by Little Feet, Poison Whiskey by Leonard Skinner. You know, we would do these band arrangements, and depending on where you were at as a musician, you would play later in the set or earlier on varying degrees of difficulty. And these could go on for 3 hours at a time, these shows, but it showed me how you put together a musical ensemble, how to keep a crowd entertained. And like, because with performance, there's only really two rules. One is get their attention, and the second is keep it. And if you can do that for the course of 2 hours or 2.5 hours, I think there's a kind of a magic to that and a weird symbiosis. And I think like music is that, a performance specifically, there is a magic that binds everything in the room together. So those early performances would have been my first gigs, so to speak.
Geez, I was expecting it to be, you know, playing with friends or out busking or, you know, maybe with a couple of friends practicing with instruments, stuff like that. But that's a really sort of laying strong foundations for a music career when you're starting off like that. And, you know, getting, learning how to put an ensemble together like that, as you said, it's very admirable. It's the first time I've actually heard it as well from a guest. But
well, there would, now what you mentioned about playing in a garage with friends, there was lots of that too. I remember punk was a big, when I was in school, I was about 15 in 2007, and punk was a big thing. So bands like the bands that I was in, I remember my friend Kevin Brannigan, who was the drummer, every week he was in a different band, or the band had a different name. I remember there was like the Wannies, the Sugar Plum Fairies. Unbelievable. Now they're all punk groups, and so there was something. And I remember him doing his first gig, and he came in with like a tiny, like a post-it of a gig poster that he had in the Legal Eagle in town in Dublin. And I just thought it was amazing that I could, to see his band's name on this tiny little leaflet was just, there was something buzzy about that. So I played in punk bands, but they never would have gone any further than the rehearsal room. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I get you. Yeah. I get you. Was that something you would have been like a chore to you now to be playing that sort of music, or would you have been interested in playing it as much as the Clondalkin School of Music?
It's like when you talked about loving Elvis records, and there's the part of you that just wants to be young and wants to have mates, wants to have friends. And then there's the love of music, and there's a love of a certain type of music. And that like those two things crossed when I was a teenager, because most of my friends were in punk bands. There's bands like Squirrel Racer. I'm never going to remember all of the names because they just changed so much. But it was the way I went to an all boys school, right? And even something as juvenile or as simple as when there was also a local girls school. So when the two would get together for like a concert recital, you just wanted to be the guy with the pink Stratocaster playing Sugar We're Going Down. You know what I mean? Because that's what everybody seems to be going for. And if I had gotten up on stage and started to sing Unchained Melody, I just don't think it would have had the same effect, even though that's what I really would have wanted to do. And time has been the wiser, because that is what I do now. And that's what I've made a life out of. Time is a funny thing. And maybe, you know, to be singing it in a dance hall of 500 or 600 of your contemporary peers at 15, it doesn't have the same effect as maybe the punk rock group did. But I would have, if somebody said to me, you play bass, I'd have learned bass within the week that we had rehearsals just to be part of the band, you know?
Yeah. It's all about knowing your audience, I suppose.
At this stage it is, yeah.
Your last gig you played then?
Well, the last big thing I did, there's a Irish Cultural Centre in Clondalkin, where I'm from, called Áras Cróna. And every year around St. Patrick's Day, Kíle, I'm sure you're familiar with Kíle, come and do a big concert in the Halle. It's about 250 capacity type venue. And for the last 10 years, I would always do support for them. And that was on like March the 7th. And then I had some small, like, I have friends who would play regular pub gigs in the locality, and I'd maybe drop in and play a couple of songs with them or something. I never did that. Well, I did at one point, but I don't do it now as a regular thing. So there would have been little sing songs and stuff like that, you know? But the last gig that it was like just me, I can't remember. Where you There's that many. I can't remember.
Suppose as well with the last year as well, it's hard to remember the last proper one, you know, when so much time has passed.
And everything's been virtual, like stuff like this, you know, and I've done easily 100 virtual concerts between last year and now. So, and that's still, you still have to kind of be on your game for that, but it's not the same as, you know, the kind of the nervous sweats that you might get before going on before 400 or 500 people, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I was just going to ask how do you find that, you know, because with a virtual gig, I imagine you're just in a quiet room on your own. You're looking at a screen. Whereas obviously when you're playing to a live audience, you can feel the audience, you're getting the energy off the audience. What is it like to approach a virtual gig as a musician compared to the live performance?
In the beginning, the first 3 or 4 that I did were weird because it's almost like you're playing a slot machine. You know, you're waiting for a virtual response. You're waiting for a comment or a love heart or a thumbs up. And you don't do that. In fact, you do the exact opposite live, where you were just focusing on getting the best version of the song across without letting nerves or, you know, who you might be opening for or who's in the room weigh in on your mind. Whereas now nobody's there. And it's just like now I'm looking into a phone. And that's even a little bit more nerve-wracking, I think.
Really?
Well, in the sense that, like, if I'm playing to a room of 160 people, I can see almost the whites of everybody's eyes. But if I'm staring into a phone, I'm potentially playing to any number of people. And one isn't better and one isn't worse, but it's just, you approach it differently, you know?
Yeah, I get you. Yeah. I had it in my head that the virtual gig, even though there could be anyone from around the world, you know, joining in, watching, that you could almost psychologically might trick yourself into thinking it's a practice session. I know you have to be on your A game, give your best shot, but to get through it, you could think, right, it's just me and the camera, or me and the phone. It's a practice session to, you know, enhance my skill set. Just so happens people are watching. But when you put it like that, that there's so many people watching, and I suppose you're not seeing their faces, their reactions, really, you're just seeing the comments. I can see how it would be very nerve-wracking as well, you know?
Like with any great concert, especially when you do what I do, which is, if you look at the concerts of, like I mentioned, Jim Croce and Harry Chapin, I put myself in the category of like a storyteller. So there has to be some kind of give and take between myself and the audience. And the same goes if I'm doing a live stream. So if I just sit down and start to play, whether it's just playing the piano or playing the guitar, and I never interact and I don't make reference to the people who are tuning in, and there's no give and take, well, then that's not really entertaining for anybody. And you'll notice the numbers just drop and drop and drop while you're playing, because which only goes to show that with that kind of music, there has to be just something a little extra. And I think that's attention from the performer. And it's the one thing that's missing today. That I feel with young solo artists and singer-songwriters and that whole gradient, that it's not just hold the guitar and hope to God you get through the song. You have to get to a point, and like practice is a dirty word, but you need to be able to get to a point where you at your best in your practice room is you a multiple of that when you're on stage. And you need to be like, there has to be room for improvisation. And you can pull off a fantastic, difficult, complex fingerstyle piece. But if there isn't that human connection, you notice people switch off all the time, you know?
With a live audience then, And speaking of nerves, so to speak, I've heard people say that the larger audience is actually easier. It's easier to walk out on stage in front of a massive audience versus a smaller audience of, say, 20, 30, 50 people even. That it's almost like 50 people versus one crowd, if you get what I mean.
Yeah, it becomes a representative of the whole thing. So like whatever, but then for that as well, if you're playing to a couple of thousand people, if there's a 6 or 7 hard shots in the front row and that's all you can see and it's intimidating, look, that represents the whole thing. So sometimes, like for what I do as a singer-songwriter, if there's more than 4,000 people, the point has gone away from the performance because all the intimacy is lost. And I'm not saying like anyone would be blessed to be playing to that many people, but unless you can hem in the audience, then when those numbers get to that size, half of the intimacy of what I do is gone. Because if I'm doing, like if you listen to some of the tracks from the EP, some of them would almost require not pin drop silence, but at least a certain degree of focus so that the song gets across. That gets harder to do the more people that there are. So it comes down to, that's where your stagemanship comes into play. It's like, you know, quiet, slow, fast, quiet, you know what I mean? Being able to keep the momentum going with a bit of variety, I think.
Yeah. It's really about your stagemanship as well then. That comes into it a lot. And back to knowing your audience, how to almost control the audience as well. That's obviously something you would have learned back in the Clondalkin School of Music as well, learn how to master those skills as well as playing instruments, singing, studying music, I imagine.
Well, that was what I was saying to you, but my teacher, Peter Stanton, would have told us there is only two rules to performance. One is get their attention, the other is keep it. Now, how you go about getting their attention and keeping it is two totally different things. But it all comes down to what's the essence of what you do. Like if you're in a punk rock band, no one's there to pay attention to the melodies. It's almost like a violent act. You know, you have mosh pits and stuff like that. If you're in a jazz group, then all of the emphasis is on the melodic sophistication and the key changes and stuff like that. So it's about knowing where you fit in all of that stuff. And once I got comfortable with knowing who I was as a performer, all the other shit just falls into place.
Yeah. We'll move on to your, I don't want to say your worst gig, but the worst experience you've had at a gig.
I've never talked about this, but when I think of worst gigs, this certainly comes to mind. I'm not going to say where it was because I've actually had a lot of memorable gigs in the same place. But I was doing, it was a piano set and it was in a venue that didn't need a piano set. Let's put it that way. Or at least my interpretation of this was I was going to play like a jazz bebop nightclub, which I now realize, I don't know how many of those we have, but that certainly wasn't what this was. There was two young guys they might have only been a bit older than me, but they were leaving. So I was playing it. See, if I give away too many details, it's very easy to tell where I was. I don't want to do that. But as they were leaving, they kind of like spat in my direction and were giving me like the thumbs down. Now, I have never, like, it's not like I got hit in the face with a gollier, but it was that gesture of like, that's how little we think of what you're doing. And I wasn't like, I was probably singing Crocodile Rock or, you know, The Way You Look Tonight. It was, to me, very inoffensive music. But they came to get the, you know, boom, boom, boom nightclub atmos. And I don't know how you're supposed to recreate that on a piano. But again, like I said, that venue, I had some amazing memories there too. So it's, and that's why I don't want to bring up where it was, purely for that sake, because it wouldn't be fair for me to say, oh, but there have been experiences or people just say, now that's quite a few years ago. But there's been experiences like that, but it's never been bad enough to make me think I'm not doing this anymore. It's too tough, you know, but I've had some pretty bad ones.
I can imagine. That's actually shocking though, that they done that. That's, you know, it's, if you don't appreciate someone's music or if they, if they're playing a different style of music than you anticipated or you expected seeing, that sort of reaction is really uncalled for, like, you know.
But dude, imagine how many buskers you've passed in your life, and you imagine someone with a nylon string guitar playing a little hymn or a canticle. Where would you need to be mentally to spit at someone like that? You know what I mean? And that, for me, those things always say more about the person who does it than what you're doing. But I just couldn't understand it. But it, in terms of, I had a whole hour of a set still to go. And I was like, how am I going to do this? You know, these were two intimidating guys. I'm like, should I just stop? You know, should I go over to whoever's on the bar and say, I can't keep playing, you know? But it nothing, and no bad experience was ever bad enough to deter me. Like, I was a busker. You know, I've had people try to rob me. I've had people threaten to break my guitar over my head. So the scary aspect of it, it never made me go, oh, feck this, I'm not doing this anymore. I think it just makes you, it's character building, I think, you know?
Yeah, yeah. True, just makes you tougher, or gives you a tougher skin almost.
I think so.
It's funny that you mentioned the busker. A recent guest as well said that to try out new songs, he'll walk outside the studio when he's in the middle of recording. He'll walk outside the studio, sit on the step, and start busking on the street to gauge the reaction from people walking by. And I was telling him that when I was growing up, you know, Ireland is very popular for buskers there. You know, especially in Dublin, every 10, 20 feet in the middle of summer, there's a busker somewhere. And I remember being a child and looking at these guys busking and thinking to myself, as a musician, they have the hardest job ever, you know, and seeing guys on MTV or U2 filling stadiums, I was like, those guys have it easy. I would rather be filling stadiums than standing on the street in my own town where people that know me are walking by. You know, it must have been very intimidating to start busking and to be busking.
You know what it is? It's the fear that that's all you'll ever be thought of as. That for me, I'll tell you one story. It was a Christmas. I used to busk with a guy, Evan Walsh, and Evan was like a beacon for me because he was like a busker's busker. He knew what days, you know, why is a Thursday better than a Friday? You know, this kind of unusual logic. And the reason is because on a Friday, people are thinking, I'm going to meet the girlfriend and go to the cinema, or I'm going to go out with the lads. And spending money is the last thing you want to do with a busker. Whereas Thursday, you have the excitement of knowing tomorrow's Friday, and then you're more inclined to give money. He knew things like this that I would never think of. But I remember it was Christmas of 2012, and he said to me, we should go for a drink. People who work in offices and shoe stores and department stores go for a Christmas drink. That's what we're going to do. So he picked a date. And I remember we were walking by the Shelbourne and getting out of this big black Mercedes van or taxi was this family. And they were like the quintessential, I call, not office family, but like wealthy, like sickeningly wealthy. Right. And there was, the perfect platonic family of like, the mother, the father, the daughter, the son, but like the daughter is the captain of the lacrosse team and the son is a rugby winning guy and he's got the perfect girlfriend. You understand what I mean? So I'm using terms that today you can't say as flippantly. So I have to be careful what I say. But it was like idyllic. They were all going in for a Christmas drink in a Shelbourne of all places, like the epitome of wealth and sophistication in Dublin. Now it as looked upon by some. And I kind of had a heart sink moment. And Evan put his hand on my shoulder because he knew what I was observing. He said, they don't appreciate what they have. Now, that's a very flippant statement to say, and I'm sure they did. But I knew what he meant was that they've probably grown up in wealth. They've always had whatever it is they wanted. They never went hungry. This isn't even that special an event for them. But he says, any success we ever achieve, we'll know the value of it because we know what it was like to busk for a tenner. You know what I mean? And I think that perspective, because when I would meet people, certain people who I went to school with who didn't particularly like me would say, oh, you're still busking. And it's almost as if you're saying, he's still homeless. You know, do you get me?
Yeah.
You know what I mean by that?
Yeah. I completely get you. It's that must have, you know, back to the whole thing about having a thick skin, that must have been tough to hear and tough to get past when people are passing comments like that.
Yeah, it was rough. Yeah, it was. I had my tribe of lads, you know, like David Kozak, who is still in the music business, and Evan Walsh, Joanna Byford. There was a lot of musicians around the same age at the same time. So we all kind of fell back on each other, and we had our own haunts, like we'd drink in Whelan's or Captain America. I remember during the week, it was gorgeous in the summer. You go up to Captain America's for a few cheap cocktails. So we had our tribe that we moved in. But when you'd meet people, so I would have been 21 and I was still busking. I say that as if it's a defeatist thing, but I'd meet somebody who I went to college with, and they'd be working for their dad's company, and they'd be, you know, earning whatever a week, and they'd be driving a nice car, and they'd look at me in my denims and my corduroy like I was a street urchin. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah, I get you. I get you. At the same time, though, you know, you chose the life you wanted. They chose the life they wanted. Maybe in some people's opinion, their life was more so forced upon them. You had the freedom to choose what you wanted. You wanted to do music. You were going about it the right way to build good foundations, you know, and set yourself up for the future. You know, that's another way of looking at it. You know, I'm sure those guys wouldn't look at it like that. But it's all about, I find with creativity and especially music, it's important to know the struggle. Do you know what I mean?
Absolutely.
And it breeds creativity. You know, so it's almost needed.
It certainly gives you a bedrock to build everything up from. You know what I mean? Like, for example, this Friday, I'm doing a gig which will air as kind of a whole program this summer. But I'm doing a gig in the Bord Gáis. Now, if you had said to me at 21, at the end of this week, even if it was during the pandemic, and even if it was like this would have been a full capacity event, but we can't because of the coronavirus or the present state of lockdown or whatever you want to call it. If you'd said that to me, I wouldn't have believed you. Or maybe I would have, I don't know. But just the contrast now that we're talking about working on the street and trying to make a crust, even sometimes just making bus fare to get home, you know, to going from there to these type of places was a transition I think every musician hopes to get to, but it doesn't always happen. And I think one of the things that busking does is if it keeps a fire in your belly, if you can push through a rainy day on Grafton Street when four people have tried to rob you and there's a guy who's waiting up the road with a Stanley blade for you and want to do is die, you know? You know, that teaches you something.
I can imagine. I'd say there's many a person that turned off. You know, that even those words, someone waiting up the street with a Stanley knife. Geez, I think I'd be putting away the guitar or whatever instrument for good, you know, and I wouldn't be going back.
There were guys at that time who their whole thing was intimidating people. You know, it could be the guy who goes out for a cigarette in his break from the jewelry store, but they wanted to see, would you show fear? You know, how quickly would you hand over your money? And I think, because I was never, those threats never came to fruition, but it was just to shake you. It was like, okay, well, if I give you money, will you leave me alone? And that's all it ever was. And most provocations like that tend to be the case, that they just want to see, will you hand over the guitar, hand over the money or whatever it is, which I never did. Thank God. but again, I always had my tribe, you know, I always had my gang. And I think when you have like-minded people to fall back on, it does make the journey, which can, like, penury is a rough thing to go through. But when you have your pals, it does make it easier.
Yeah. Yeah. We'll flip it around for a minute. So when it comes to busking, we don't want to scare anyone off of busking. What has been some of the better experiences when it comes to busking that you've had?
If you stand on the busiest retail street in any city, the whole world passes you by because you get tourists from other countries, celebrities. I mean, I don't know how many stories. I met Conan O'Brien through busking. I could go on. I mean, like, one thing that I've been blessed to be a part of is the Christmas Eve busk. Almost since its inception, I met Glenn Hanser through busking. And then a eventually was asked to come and be a part of the Christmas Busk, which in recent years, there wasn't one last year, but I think the last 10 years I've been there every year. But it's magic because I could be on Grafton Street from 1 o'clock in the day till 11 o'clock at night. So the whole city gets the chance to pass you. Mm. And there's some stories I can tell you and there's some that I can't, but it's the memories that you make and the objective standpoint that you're at, because nobody's there to see you. You just happen to be there. And if they give you money, that's validation. And that validation can buy a burger, Coca-Cola, maybe a few drinks. Maybe you've got a date the next week and you could save up some money from that. Do you know what I mean? Like there was a value system that that's how I learned the value for money was, if you're good enough, someone will give you money. If you make a lot of money, you must be pretty good, you know?
Yeah. And I imagine it's not even about the money. It's, you know, it's the fact that they value what you're doing so much that they're wanting to give you something. You know, it doesn't matter how much, it's just that they're showing their appreciation for what you're actually doing. And that must really mean something when someone does that, you know?
A lot of times for me, it was about the money because, again, I never subsidized music with something else. This wasn't like, I'll go out and do 2 hours of busking, but I'll go back to work on my job in a leisure center. Do you know what I mean? I didn't.
Yeah.
So that was my only form of income. So if I wanted to do anything that weekend, you had to get the guitar and go out and sing some songs. So like it was quite literally singing for your supper.
Yeah, yeah. I'm actually glad that you mentioned the Christmas busk. I've seen a couple of videos on YouTube of you singing in the Christmas busk, and I think Hozier is beside you, Glenn Hansard. But I've had guests on from America who didn't really fully understand what it was. And the way they put it to me was, is it true that Bono stands on the street and sings at Christmas time? But that must have been like not a turning point in your career, but real validation that you're getting the chance to do that when so many legendary musicians from Ireland get to do that, you know, and then you're being asked to do it as well. I know that sounds like I'm saying that you're not at their level, but I didn't mean it like that at all.
I totally get you. And like the first one that I ever did was in 2012 or 11. I can't remember. But the year that I did it, Bono wasn't there. This is always, when people ask me about the Christmas books, they're always like, and was Bono with that one? And I totally get it. I do understand it. And what always freaked me out about it was people used, like this happens on Christmas Eve. So the next day is Christmas Day. And you would get people coming from Italy, Spain, Brazil, predominantly Catholic countries where Christmas is of some significance. You know, I would understand if you didn't celebrate Christmas. But these people would travel to Ireland in the hopes that they were going to get this close to Bono, you know, to their hero. And when if I knew on a given year that he wasn't going to be there, and they would show up early and they're like, what time is he coming? And you know, in your heart of hearts, he's not going to be there. I'd never say it. I'd say, I don't know. You know, it's a sporadic thing. Sometimes he's here, sometimes he's not. I think the magic of it is, what's nice about the Dublin scene is having seen how people have grown. You know what I mean? I remember one particular year, the busk was to be at the top of Grafton Street. And Dermot Kennedy, who now has gone on to do amazing things. I knew Dermot really well. And Dermot and me used to busk not far from one another. He used to busk at the top of Grafton Street and I was on South King Street. And I saw him way at the back of a crowd. And I said, can everybody just move and let Dermot come through? Hmm. And he came all the way up the front and we were playing like Stand By Me. And in the distance, he said, Col, what's happening at Dunn's? And we had got the wrong spot. So here's all these people queuing in front of us thinking, oh, this is where the busk is. But people at the back had started to figure out, oh no, it's down at Dunn's. So there was this mad run up Grafton Street. And myself and Dermot, I remember we're holding our guitars in the air and he was just like, this is insane. But that was the nature of like how it could just, it was like a mad mass gathering. And then as quickly as it started, it was over.
Yeah.
So there's a magic, like that could only happen in Ireland, I think. It just wouldn't happen anywhere else.
Without a doubt. I hope I haven't ruined my next question now, but your best experience at a concert or at a gig, what was that?
Like what I was talking to you about, the graduation levels from busker to solo artist to bar performer to whatever. For me, like one of the greatest pieces of validation was in 2017, I was asked to support Show Lynn in Vicar Street. And from the very start, this was always going to be a sold out gig. The guys have an insane following. And I remember during the sound check, well, after my sound check, I remember going for a walk. I had the stage to myself and I pushed standing capacity. Vicar Street can hold almost 2,000 people. And I remember just sitting on the stage, like I'm sitting here talking to you and thinking, Bob Dylan played here, Randy Newman played here, Neil Young played here, Jackson Browne played here. And just thinking, because I like, there's a thing that Bruce Springsteen says, if you don't mark your successes, the day when your ship finally comes in is going to feel like another day at the office. And I never wanted it to feel like that. So anytime a big thing was happening, I would always sit with it. And maybe I'd just get a pint from the bar and sit on the stage, cross-legged, and just look up at the lighting rig or look at the sound engineer's booth or all the little guitars that are all tuned and ready to go for this concert and this place is going to be full. That was a huge, like that was huge. You know, there's been a couple of great ones, but moments like that when someone said to me before, it's when your followers are people you don't know or your people come to your show or people you don't know. That's when you feel like you're doing something right, you know?
Yeah, yeah. I haven't heard that one before, but it's actually one of the best ones, the best way I could think of putting it, actually, when your followers are people that you don't know.
Because it's like, for the longest time when you're doing gigs, what do? You send event invitations to friends and family and anyone who come and you know half the room. And it's more moral support than anything else. But when you can put on a show and there's people who you've never met, you don't know, coming to see you. And like, that's not a great example of it because that was Show Lynn's gig. But I remember there was we had a merchandise stand and like that wasn't the first time that it happened, but it's all, if someone who you don't know, who's older or younger than you, comes up and wants to buy your CD or get a picture with you or something like that, no matter how many times it happens, the magic of that is never lost them, you know?
Yeah, I imagine it's a very special feeling. If you had to pick one standout moment then in your career so far, that has been the greatest or the most memorable point for you, what would have been?
I think, again, it's my biggest fear. I won't say biggest fear, but I always had this, I was conscientious of the fact that, will people always just view me as being a busker? Because I was a busker from the time I was 15. Till I was like 21, you know, and that I feel sometimes when people think of street performers, that's all you'll ever be. It's like, you're a busker. They don't think of you in terms of like, I was 17 and I was studying Rachmaninoff and music by the Brodsky Quartet. Now I went out in the street to learn how to be a performer as well. But I thought, well, you know, there's more feathers to my bow than just, you know, going out and singing "You Ain't Going Nowhere" by Bob Dylan. And I remember when I signed with Bio Records in 2015, that was a real breakwater point because I remember telling my mom, I remember telling my music teacher, Peter Stanton, because getting signed nowadays, maybe it doesn't hold the same cachet, but back, you know, it's not that long ago, but for people who knew me, it was a really big thing because that was like the graduation process from, okay, solo artists, like I always think of it like you're shaking the trouser leg of the world. And then one day they turn around and go, what you want? And there's your moment. There's your moment where somebody says, okay, you want validation? Show me what you got.
Especially in Ireland, because I always imagine Ireland is a very hard place for a singer to get on. You know, I always imagined they'd have to go to maybe London or even further abroad to America if they really want to try get on or even get signed. You know, because even though Ireland is known globally for its amazing talent when it comes to music, I always, maybe it's something you don't know unless you're in the music industry, but I always imagine that there's not that many opportunities to actually, you know, to break into it in Ireland.
Sorry to cut you off there. I think there were a lot of bands when I was young Bebo was the first social media. And I often felt that there were bands who, if they could have stuck it out a bit longer until things like Facebook and Twitter and Instagram became prominent, that they would have made careers for themselves on an international playing field. Because the funny thing is, the majority of CD orders that I get or radio play is all in the States. And the only reason that is the case is because of social media. So I feel like that's played a role that I don't think people give enough credit to, because it opens you up to an unlimited market that doesn't have to be where you're centered. And maybe not enough people utilize it that way. Maybe they do. I don't know. But it certainly, for me, like I, when Dublin was more of a village and when Ireland was one thread on a long bow of places where you could go to try and make it in an industry. Like for me, I remember being 15 in 2007 and thinking, what music scene? Do you know what I mean? Like, I know I was only a teenager, but like I had friends who they would have done a gig in an Eddie Rockets if they would have been left. You know, like there wasn't, I know we were under 18, so that does account for a lot of it, but like there were bands, but there, no, again, I was probably too young. There's people who'd say, well, you were 15, what would you have done? But it didn't feel like there was a scene, you know, it was just this big concrete jungle of a city. And if you could get a gig in a Corky's or a Champion Sports in the corner, like you would have taken it, you know, and try and get your mates to turn up and buy tickets and stuff like that. So I don't know. I just, like, I'm really fortunate now because I'm recording and I'm writing with Charlie McGettigan, who, like, he was like an idol for me growing up in terms of songwriters. And to make that turnaround from like Busker from Clondalkin, who just wants to make it in an industry that he knows nothing about, to going and working with the people who you admire, for me, like that was, you know, that was a big deal.
Yeah. Geez. It actually sounds like the screenplay for a movie almost, you know, a young guy busking on the street and works his way all the way up. And now he's working with his idol. It's literally the stuff of dreams. You know, it's very admirable. We, at this stage, we normally get slightly more personal, but you don't need to worry. We're not going to get too personal. We're not going to delve into your personal life or anything.
Okay.
So if you got the chance to see any performer from any stage in history, can be current or it could be someone who has passed away from the past, in concert for one night only, who would it be?
I'd say Frank Zappa, probably.
Okay, yeah. Good choice.
He, like, we were talking about musical sophistication, the performances that he put on. I think of like some of the legendary performances in the Fillmore East, or, you know, even latterly when he was working with the London Philharmonic and his arrangements were applied to a classical or for a classical listening audience. Just to be in the man's presence, really, you know, as a spectator, that'd be amazing. What about you?
Oh, that's I find that my answer changes from week to week. It's funny.
So who's it this week?
I'd say probably Jim Morrison.
And the Doors.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, and I know it's probably, I imagine if you were going to a Doors concert, it'd be one of them things where, you know, it's like nowadays going to see Guns N' Roses or something. You don't know until they're on stage that the gig is actually going to happen.
Have you ever been to Jim's grave or anything like that?
No, I had actually got tickets, or I had plane tickets to go to Paris in April last year, believe it or not. And of course, COVID happened. So,
you would have went otherwise.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I was dragging the missus along, pretending it was going to be a romantic trip to Paris, but there was only one reason I was wanting to go there, to be honest with you.
Do you know where specifically he is?
Not in Pierre Lachey. Not,
okay.
I don't know the exact spot, but I know he's in there.
Yeah.
And obviously I've seen photos and, you know, it's been on my bucket list now, I'd say, since I was about 13, 14, since I first got into the Doors. But geez.
Isn't there the legendary graveside photo that whatever way the light is breaking through the trees, it looks like Jim in the background.
Yeah, with the white shirt and the leather
That's
pants.
Right, yeah. Yeah.
So would you have been into the Doors yourself much?
Yeah, huge. I mean, I even had, my uncle was hugely into them, and I had a vinyl copy. I still have it somewhere. I'm actually in the attic, so it's here somewhere, of Native American Prayer, or American Prayer, I think it's called, which is just a collection of his poetry. That's the whole Lizard King end of Jim. But like, I remember learning Lover Madly, or Hello, I Love You, Love Street, even the Alabama song, Show Me the Way to the Next Whiskey Bar, you know. There was a particular summer, I think when I was about 15, I remember like going through a phase of Cat Stevens, The Doors, Eric Clapton, and just sitting with I used to play a Fender Squire and trying to learn the chords to these songs. Just fabulous.
Yeah, yeah. I imagine, what did you think of the Soft Parade album, actually? I imagine that'd be closer to style of music that you'd play yourself. You know, it's very piano based and melodic.
I was in studio with my band Shiloh Palace when Ray Manzarek passed away in 2013. And I like the way he would approach, you know, the intro to Riders on the Storm.
Yeah.
So that you have all these gorgeous, well, they're not parallel fourths, but it's that unusual E minor A sequencing at the beginning. He made the keyboard an instrument that played a different role to anything that it did in previous incarnations of bands, if you know what I mean. Like, he brought it to the significance of a lead guitar. And you can't hear Jim Morrison's voice without hearing a Hammond organ, you know, in the background.
Yeah, yeah, that's very true, actually. So, very true.
Yeah, Soft Parade. And again, like, I was kind of a rocker when I was a teenager, so I could appreciate Break On Through to the Other Side, or, you know, I went through proggy phases too. So, like, I didn't really develop a strong taste for the music of the 50s and 40s till I was in my 20s, but it was there. Do you know what I mean? It was in the periphery.
Yeah, yeah.
Love the Doors, man.
Oh, they're one of the coolest. It'd be some dream, though, to get to see them. I'd actually, one of my dreams for the podcast is, I don't know if it'd make an interesting episode, but I'd be, you know, glued to the conversation if I got to interview someone that went to a Jim Morrison and the Doors concert. But I actually had tickets myself. Do you remember back in, I'd say it was 2008 or 9, when the Doors kind of reformed, but they had, I think, the guy from The Cure, or they had someone else as the lead singer, and the Kent Ireland, they were playing whatever the 02 or 3 was called back then, Tree Arena. But I had tickets, and sadly, I wasn't able to make it. And it's, when it comes to music and shows that I've been to, it's one of my biggest regrets, because obviously now you can never get to see them, you know. But it would have been some experience to get to see them.
I'd say so, yeah.
So my next question then, if you could be locked in a room for 24 hours, let's say you had to quarantine with any performer, again, from history, who would it be?
And I assume, like, we'd be talking about music or composition. Okay, okay. Yeah. Like, it's not someone that I have to sit and go through 15 hours of Monopoly with, you know. I have huge admiration now for, like, classical composers like Rachmaninoff and like Boulez and Stravinsky. Like, someone like Igor Stravinsky, someone who... Or Sanson, you know, I love the French composers as well. But the degree of complication that comes with arranging for an 82-piece orchestra, and all of this has to begin in your head or at the piano and then apply it in a time where you don't have your iPhone to record, oh, you know, this F-sharp minor sequence sounds nice, I'll just play it against this, but you've no way of doing that. Or people who, like, wrote specifically for harpsichord and have to translate that for 100 other instruments. It would just be really interesting to pick somebody's brain and say, you know, when you lived in the destitute part of Montmartre, France, where you can't pay for your heating. But, you know, and I heard quotations from composers who said to be surrounded by the written note made them feel wealthy, because, you know, the richness of music, and in particular classical composition, was enough to feed the soul, which I don't know how I'd feel if I hadn't eaten for 6 days, but those guys, like the early composers, maybe not Bach, because I think there's kind of a very educational aroma attached with that. But the guys who like it was all to play for, you know, who never received adulation in their lifetime and died destitute. You know, what is it that spurs those guys on?
Actually, I really like that answer. It's actually, I find it very insightful into who you are as a musician almost, that you know, anyone can say, oh, I'd love to spend an evening with Paul McCartney, or, well, Paul McCartney is probably a bad example because he's a bit of a genius when it comes to songwriting, but say, you know, any, just pick a name out of the hat from any band, but you're actually picking, you know, older genius level composers and genius musicians. You know, that's I find that a great insight into you as a performer, as a musician as well.
Well, when you, like, if you think of the Instagram age, and you think of what motivates people to, like, some of the best advice I ever got was from Anthony Staunton, when he said to me, in anything you do, whenever you do it and wherever you do it, know your motive, know what it is that's motivating you to do it. And where some people will feign sincerity and say, I'm all about the music, man. But behind it, it's, you know, they're looking to acquire 200, like a quarter of a million, so that they can launch their own line of footwear. It's really strange. No, it's really strange today. Like, that there are performers who they take up an instrument because somebody mentioned at their confirmation party that they have a half decent voice, and they go on a television program to gain a certain amount of capital so that they can start a makeup line. I just don't get it. I would shudder to think what a Boulez or a Rachmaninoff would say to someone who you're using their diaspora or their means of creativity, a means of making a livelihood, to not jeopardize it, but to strictly from a monetary perspective, because you know, it's a more interesting career path than advertising, and that you effectively, really what you're just thinking about is the financial side of it, which I say this all the time. If I lived behind a cluster of bins, I'd be doing this anyway. Do you know what I mean? I'm not, just because the going's good doesn't mean that's why I'm here. I told you, like, when I was busking about walking home in the rain after being threatened for what little money you made, you know, if you weren't in it for the music, you wouldn't keep going.
It definitely shines through, though, your love for music, especially with this conversation. It's very easy to see, especially when you look at, you know, music nowadays and pop stars nowadays and what's in the charts and what's popular. You know, maybe I'm a bit of an old soul, but I personally get a feeling like the majority of what's popular now, those pop stars just want to be famous and want to be rich. You know, there's no love of the art or no love of the music in their performance or in popular music nowadays. What would you think of, you know, the music scene nowadays?
There's always been great music and there's always been crap music. And it depends on what end of the spectrum. You know, it's like, does the cork rise to the top or does the lime sink to the bottom? And the difference between the 1960s and today from a contemporary music perspective is that the stuff that was in the charts had a certain degree of compositional substance. So the Beatles could have had 5 singles in the charts at one time, but it had substance to it. But the generation that preceded, the kids who were listening to the Beatles, said, sure, that's all crap. And I shudder sometimes to think that maybe I'm just wrong about all this stuff, and that, you know, the brilliance of Cardi B won't hit me until I'm 60. You know, I just don't know. But I, like, for me, I write music for the exchange student who's working in Hodges and Figgis and likes to listen to concertos on their lunch break. That's who I'm making music for. I'm not making music for somebody who is overwrought with excitement because Justin Bieber retweeted something that they share. Yeah, no, I'm not saying I'm against that, because all of those things have their place. But I'm just saying, well, here's something that's a little bit different. Here's something that isn't the top 40 or the hot top 100 or whatever. You can take it or you can leave it. But it's just about giving people other options, because all of these, like I said, all of these things have their place. And I'm sure the purchasers or the people who are patrons for like mainstream contemporary music, that has as much melodic significance in their life as Paul Simon did for me. And I'm not taken away from that, because I don't like music snobbery. But what I do just gives someone another option. It's like, if you're sick of ham on rye, well, why don't, you know, maybe let's just have a little bit of tiger loaf with cheese. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
That's it. You know?
I think it's you deserve an enormous amount of respect, you know, for what you're doing. Especially when, as I said, the music scene today, and, you know, what we just said about people being famous and all, and the style of music you have, and the clear love for music and the art that you have. I feel like I'm repeating the word admirable, but it's very admirable. And I've gained an enormous amount of respect for you now as a musician. Obviously,
thanks,
I did beforehand, but it's just shot through the roof in my eyes. Now you're, you know, I can't even put it into words, but it's, you know, you deserve a lot of respect for it. But and I know my listeners are going to think the same. It's refreshing to see a musician nowadays, especially a younger musician, who is in it for the music.
I think whatever you get into, like if it's sales, if it's advertising, if it's the stock exchange, if it's music, if the whole purpose is to maybe make your little corner of what you do a little bit better than the way you found it, there's a wholesome quality to that. And I'm not like, I don't, it's just about giving people other options. If you do what you do well, it'll find people. And I think if your intention is to get in because you want to be the next whoever and you want to make a load of money, those are hollow ambitions. Go do something. Go be part of a reality show where you can be famous for nothing. And the fly on the wall aspect of those type of programs is what sells. And all those things have their place. Enjoy it and have a great life. If you're going to get into something that's as difficult as the music industry, I mean, you'd want to be doing it for the love of it, because it's not a cakewalk. So if your intentions weren't pure from the beginning, it's going to be very tricky. We talked a little bit about popular music. My first two EPs got to number one in the Irish charts. And I remember, I won't mention the name of the blog, but they posted, I brought out a single with Bure Records in 2016. And they said, and after two successful climbs to the top of the charts, Colm Gavin fails to hit number one with this single, My Little Sweetheart and Me, which cuts short the hat trick record or whatever. I was horrified, because I thought, it was never my intention to make music specifically for the charts, and the charts have their role and that's fine, but that was never the be all and end all. You know, if only six people ever bought my album and one of them came up and said, I really enjoyed that song, and you know, that key change you did, that would be enough validation, I feel.
Yeah. Yeah. One of my final questions, so, and I'm intrigued to see what you're going to pick. If there was one song that had to appear on the soundtrack to your life, what would it be?
I suppose it'd have to be something like Always Look on the Bright Side of Life or something tongue in cheek, you know? No, yeah. It's a tricky question, but it's a good question. Maybe the next song that I write, I don't know. You mean by someone else?
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh,
I think it's actually one of them questions you kind of need to go off and maybe sit on a beach and ponder for a while. You know,
it's a tough one, but also, to be honest with you, man, like at the end of the day, I don't know, it's playing out your life like a movie, which sometimes life can be a little bit like a movie. You could pick anything by Sanson, maybe The Swan by Sanson. If I was to be really greedy now, I think I'd, because it's just a gorgeous piece of music,
yeah, yeah. Mm. And, what's next on the cards for you?
Well, as we're talking, there are people in smoke-filled boardrooms around the country and around the world talking about how are we going to open up the live circuit again. So, like, if we had spoken this time last year, we'd be talking about everything cloistering down, and now we're talking about it reopening again. So I've got like, so I've got an EP, the 1992. This should be where I shamelessly plug this.
Oh, yeah.
The 1992 tapes, which comes out this July. It's five tracks of original material. It's just me, a piano-driven EP. So it's a vocal and piano. This is, if you've grown tired of just hearing the bog standard threshings of what pop music offers, here's something a little bit different. Something with flavors of ragtime, blues, musical theater influenced in some respects, just something that's a slight divergence from the regular that I think give your ears a bit of variety, and I think you'll really enjoy it. Myself and Charlie McGettigan have plans to bring out a single in about September, October. I've plans to do some work in the States, stuff that was postponed in 2020 that's now moved to 2021. So it's going to be thing I can already, and also this July, I'll be giving a very special performance in the Borgosh on a gorgeous Rittmuller concert grand piano, and that performance will air this July. So there's lots of stuff going on. If you can keep up to date with all my stuff on Colm Gavin Music on Facebook and Colm Gavin on Instagram.
Perfect. I was just going to ask you, where is the best place to stay up to date?
It's drilled in my head now.
I'd say you say it in your sleep almost.
I know.
So another one of your songs are going to play us out this evening. Would you like to tell us a bit about it, introduce it?
So this song is called Your Little Corner of the Moon. Again, we talked about where these songs come from and the writing process and stuff like that. And this, I often think of this song as like a Woody Allen screenplay. It opens up with a bad first date joke. If there are seven wonders in this world, then you must be the eighth. She said, I only ordered rice. Now it seems there's cheese here on my plate. I said, I guess that's not the kind of thing you'd hear in a first date, but if I didn't say it now, I never will. It's kind of an unrequited love song. It's a bit as close as my music gets to unrequited love, but it has charted in the indie charts in Japan and in Australia already. And I think for a song that goes over the 5.5 minute mark, that's not bad going. So I'm proud of the old year.
Perfect. Well, all that's left to say then is thanks a million for coming on. I've really enjoyed it.
Pleasure. Absolute pleasure. And it was great to talk to you.
Seven wonders in this world, then you must be the eighth. She said, I only ordered rice. Now it seems there's cheese here on my plate. I said, I guess that's not the kind of thing that you'd hear on a first date. But if I didn't say it now, I never will. She had the kind of eyes that poets from Alaska right about, that could freeze you with one glance, but that you'd burn inside without. And as her feet would glide down Main Street, all the boys would scream and shout, I hope there's someone out there screaming for still. And all the girls eat mashed potatoes as I swallow humble pie. Problem shared is a problem still, I don't need to tell you why. Her cage door's standing open, but she won't rest until she flies to her little corner of the moon. It was late September, I recall, there was gold beneath our feet. By circumstance, I learned to dance in her arms out in the street. And the fragrance of her hair gave off the taste of something sweet. I'd have stayed right there forever if I could. She said that love is like a lottery as the red lights fade to blue. I don't know what it is I'm searching for, but tonight perhaps it's you. Still, I don't want the kind of heart heart that sticks to my shirt sleeves like glue. And then she kissed me like she thought I understood. All the girls eat mashed potatoes as I swallow humble pie. A problem shared is a problem still. I don't need to tell you why. Her cage door's standing open, but she won't rest until she flies to her little corner of the moon. From the time we started, I'm not only here till the rain has parted. I'll always be true and I'm open hearted, and it's open just for you and everything you do. If you can do that too. Oh, but she just sighed and said, think of us as passing ships that were never meant to sail. There's such a high price for the quiet life, and my freedom's not for sale. I'm like a wild wind that can't reduce itself to a passing summer gale. If this were any other time for you, I would. It's only 3 weeks since she left, but there's a cold chill in the air. There's not a trace of her on Main Street, but I still see her everywhere. And Mama told me she'll come back, son, if you just act like you don't care. Still, I know this time goodbye meant bye for good. All the girls eat mashed potatoes as I swallow humble pie. A problem shared is a problem still. I don't need to tell you why. But every night it seems in my wildest dreams, it is always she and I in her little corner of the moon.
Hey, I hope you enjoyed this week's episode. If you did, why not reach out and let us know? You can find us on all social media, just search for Concerts That Made Us Podcast. And also, be sure to check out our website at www.concertsthatmadeus.com. That's the best place to stay up to date on everything that is Concerts That Made Us. Until next week, keep rocking.
Hey, what are you guys still doing here? The show's over. It's over. You can go home. Go on. We'll see you next time. We'll be here. Bye.